Listen to the best of the church's music for the Epiphany season at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the Epiphany season, 24/7. LutheranPublicRadio.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. The headline says, Site of Jesus' Trial May Have Been Found in Jerusalem. And now I'm a little fuzzy on archaeology. I don't know exactly what's been found and what hasn't. I know that there are a lot of competing claims, especially in and around Jerusalem, and that archaeology in that city is a really difficult task, that it is almost impossible to do because you're trying to do archaeological work in a, well, an occupied city and one that is also torn with all sorts of political strife, kind of like trying to change the oil on your car while driving down the highway. But they believe that they have found a place, one of the places where Jesus was tried during Holy Week. Joining us to talk about this reported discovery of the place of Jesus' trial in Jerusalem, Dr. Craig Evans. He's professor of New Testament at Acadia Divinity College in Nova Scotia, Canada, and he's author of several books, including Jesus and His World, The Archaeological Evidence. Dr. Evans, welcome back.
Thank you very much. Good to be with you, Todd.
How is it that 2,000 years on, they are still finding things in and around Jerusalem, significant sites, like perhaps even in this case, the place where Jesus might have been tried?
Well, it's not surprising at all, really, because this is such an ancient civilization. Almost anywhere you dig in Israel, you're going to unearth things, and especially a city like Jerusalem. King David conquered Jerusalem about 1,000 B.C., so there's 3,000 years of history from then to now. But, you know, the city was already old, even before the time of David. So it's not surprising at all as we work our way down. Think of it as a layered cake. It's almost like a tell. You work your way down. Further down you go, usually, the older it is. And so the more work like this that we do, and this is often what happens, a road is expanded, a room addition is added, something like they'll dig up something for a water pipe, you never know, and they encounter the antiquities right there. So I'm not surprised. The location is very promising. I've been to the Tower of David Museum as recently as just last summer. Beautiful spot, things to see, and I'm not surprised at all by expanding and reworking part of it that they encountered something else. So it's going to be fun to see how this unfolds.
I mean, you mentioned the Tower of David, the citadel in Jerusalem. What currently stands there, and what do they believe it's standing on top of, in essence?
Well, it's what it is, it's typical for Jerusalem. You have some newer medieval structure resting on structures that go back to the time of Herod the Great, and sometimes even all the way back to the Hasmoneans, another 200 years further back. And in a few rare cases, we can find structures that reach all the way back to the time of the First Kingdom or the First Temple and get back to 800, 900 B.C. And there's a lot of work going on at Jerusalem where that's happening. And so when you look at it, it almost looks like a medieval fortress from the outside. And that is, of course, the later work, the work that's only a mere 1,000 years old. But when you go inside, you can go into some lower levels, and you can reach back to the time of Jesus. And it is a museum, and so there are display cabinets and some very interesting artifacts, coins and whatnot that you can look at. And so I look forward to returning in June with my grad students. And, of course, we will be specifically interested in this evidence of what could be the place where Pilate interrogated Jesus and condemned him to death.
Well, that's one of the things that I found curious in the news coverage of it, and I do not think I had ever heard this before. I'm a little surprised to hear it, that I always pictured that the trials of Jesus took place in two completely different venues. Well, obviously, the Sanhedrin was a different venue, but then before Pilate, I always assumed that was an entirely different location than when Pilate sent Jesus briefly to Herod. But it sounds as though they may have taken place in the same location.
Probably so. What complicates things is that we don't always know where the Roman governor stayed. And we shouldn't assume that all of the Roman governors of Judea and Samaria stayed at the same place. Some of our listeners might not know, but Pontius Pilate spent most of his time at Caesarea Maritima, which is on the coast on the Mediterranean Sea, and only for special occasions, like a high holiday like Passover, would he then journey eastward to Jerusalem, and partly to show respect to the Jewish people for Passover, which was such a special holiday, celebrating the Exodus from Egypt, but also to just raise the level of security. And so he and extra troops would enter the city. And what we weren't sure is where exactly did Pilate stay. And so you have the Antonia Tower, which is actually on one of the corners of the temple precincts, that great square where the temple once stood within it, where today the Dome of the Rock is, that prominent building with the gold top. So did he stay in the Antonia? But most scholars now think he probably stayed in Herod's palace. And where exactly Herod's palace was, we have an idea, but it is somewhat debated what its boundaries and extensions would be. So that's what complicates things when we ask a very specific question, such as, where was Jesus when Pilate interviewed him? Because we're not entirely sure where Pilate himself was.
So it says in the coverage that it is quite likely that when Pilate is interrogating Jesus, he may be doing it at or in Herod's palace, and that when it says he sent him to Herod, it would be more or less like sending him down the hall rather than sending him across the city.
I think when Herod Antipas, whenever he journeyed south to visit Jerusalem, and it's likely he would from time to time, and especially for major holidays, that's exactly where he would stay. He would stay in his father's palace. And it would have been very large, and so it's not like they were, Pilate and Herod would have been next door to each other, but you could have several dignitaries and families staying within this compound, this complex, and hardly see each other.
The coverage also mentions a possible candidate, a likely candidate, for the area called the pavement that's mentioned by one of the gospel writers with respect to Jesus' trials. What is that?
Yeah, the pavement that's interesting. It is mentioned somewhat prominently by the fourth evangelist, the author of the Gospel of John. And it would have been a place where people could gather and stand. In the Roman administration, a Roman governor would sit on a judgment seat, a bema, as it's called. If you ever visit the archaeological site at Corinth, you'll see it displayed. It's like a dais or a platform that's raised, and there's this bema or bench on which the governor could sit, and people then could gather before him. And so we think the pavement was something like that, where people would gather, where Jesus may well have been presented and observed and sentence pronounced on him in a public way.
Someone might ask, Dr. Evans, you know, these were significant sites. The first century Christians would have certainly known exactly what John was talking about when he said the pavement. He could have just mentioned the name. They would have been able to locate the place in Jerusalem. Why do we have such big question marks about their locations today?
Oh, that's a very good question. The reason why is because Jerusalem was destroyed by the Romans, or seriously damaged in any case, in the year 70. And then Jerusalem was seriously damaged again some 65 years later, when Simon, son of the star, Bar Kokhba, failed in his revolt. That was 132 to 135. And so the city was badly damaged twice, and Emperor Hadrian refounded the city, and there was massive rebuilding. And what happens is damaged buildings get pushed down and become fill, and you build on top of it. And so a place that any Christian would have known in the year 35, let's say, or the year 40, would know exactly where it is and could walk right to it and say, yep, that's it, that's where it happened. Well, 100 years later, it's underneath rubble. 100 years later, something has been built over it. And then the centuries go by, and we come along, Jerusalem being built over again and again in the during the Crusader period and beyond, and then we try to dig it up and try to figure out, going down, where the first century sites, locations, where they originally were. And sometimes we're very successful, and other times we're just not sure. So that's why it's complicated. I live in Nova Scotia. We get a lot of snow, and I know this sounds silly, but by the time the thaw comes at the end of March, I can't remember exactly the lay of the land of my own property. Well, I can't imagine, after centuries go by, how anybody would be really sure where things were centuries earlier. And that's the reason we have this difficulty.
So what would constitute, and I know that this is not an exact science, but what would constitute a high degree of certainty with a site like this? What would they have to locate, or what would they have to identify in a site like David's Citadel to have the archaeological community say, you know, that's a really likely site here?
Well, there are usually three things that come into play. If an ancient writer like Josephus gives us specific directions, and he often does, he'll say it's so many stadia from this spot, and it faces the north, or this or that. He gives some specific directions, and then we find something that matches what we would expect for such and such a structure, or whatever it's supposed to be. And so we find what looks like the right thing in the right place. And those are two very important features. Then there's a third factor that comes into play, and that might be some artifact, possibly an inscription or something else like that, that would just add to our conviction that we really have found the right place. And so in a lot of times, we just don't quite find those things. Like the traditional Pool of Siloam, it just wasn't quite in the right place, even though during the Middle Ages, everyone was convinced that that was the New Testament Pool of Siloam. But just 10 years ago, we finally found the Pool of Siloam where it was supposed to be. It was just buried under fill, and doing some work involving a leaking pipe and so on, it was uncovered. And so sometimes that's what happens. But those are the key factors. Does the structure match what it's supposed to be? And that's typology, because there are Roman praetoriums and guardhouses and governor's headquarters, things like that, in many locations. So we have a sense of what they typically looked like. And is it in the place where some historian says it is? And so if you find something that looks right and it is in the right spot, that's very encouraging. And then if you happen, in doing your excavations, you find some Roman coins, let us suppose, that date to the 20s, well, then you know that's just, it's just adding confirmation that we probably have found the right spot.
Are there spots there in and around Jerusalem that are virtual certainties?
Well, I think so. I think we are. I mean, we have certainties with regard to the Temple Mount. There's no question that we have found that. We then find the mikvaot, the baptistries, and they all date back to the first century, steps, pavement that Herod built. So we really can point to a lot of things and say, this is the very pavement that Jesus and his disciples would have walked upon. These are the very steps they would have ascended. This is the very mikvah that they may well have descended into to immerse themselves prior to entering the temple precincts. There are things like that. The Via Dolorosa, which is such a popular one, and the 14 stations of the cross, that's one where, you know, over the centuries it's changed, the stations, the locations, the route, and that's much more medieval. Out of all those 14 stations, perhaps only two or three of them are accurate, if that. So there's a lot of times it's guesswork, it's based on tradition, and other times, you know, we really do get it right. And I think we've got the Pool of Siloam right. There's not much question. And by the way, I might say Church of the Holy Sepulchre probably is in the right location, because we do have first century tombs, and They were in the very location that people 100 years later remembered because the area had been buried by Emperor Hadrian. It was a slight against the Jewish people, which included the Christians. And yet 200 years after that, the local villagers said, Jesus' tomb is right there. They dug down. Sure enough, here are early first century tombs. So it's in the right place, the right kind of thing. So I think we are on pretty firm grounds in some cases.
Are there places that almost by definition will never be certainties? I'm thinking in particular the place of the crucifixion.
Yeah, never a certainty in terms of getting it right down to one or two square meters. But, you know, if you allow for like half a city block or even smaller than that, we probably are very, very close to Golgotha, the very place where Jesus was crucified. I think we likely do have the Capernaum Synagogue foundation on which the newer limestone synagogue today rests. We probably do have the house of Peter's mother-in-law where Jesus ministered. I would rank these in high probability. And, of course, I'm now talking about Galilee. So there are some places. We may well have the synagogue that Jesus likely visited at Magdala, where Mary was from, Mary Magdalene. So there are some places where the match, the correlation is so close, it's still an educated, you know, I wouldn't call it a guess exactly, but it's just an educated probability. And that's exciting because, you know, in antiquity, things change and things get destroyed and buried and then rebuilt and things move around and cities change locations. They're refounded a mile away and that sort of thing. So I'm skeptical. Do we actually have the house of Mary, the mother of Jesus, in Nazareth where she grew up as a little girl? I doubt that very much. Although you have a great example of a first-century house, you know, at the base of the Church of the Annunciation. And you know, those kinds of things I'm very skeptical about. But in some cases where we have credible evidence that an archaeologist can look back, that an unbroken chain of evidence and village memory that goes back to the first century, then the probability becomes high.
Dr. Craig Evans is our guest, professor of New Testament at Acadia Divinity College in Nova Scotia, Canada, and he's author of several books, including Jesus and His World, The Archaeological Evidence. You can purchase it under the Listen on Demand page at issuesetc.org. When we come back, we're going to talk about the nature of those trials, why it was that Jesus was brought before Pilate, why Pilate would have sent Jesus to Herod in the course of those trials as the gospel writers record them. I'm Todd Wilkin. This is Issues Etc. We are coming to you live this Tuesday afternoon, January the 6th. We talk to the biggest names in religion today, liberal bishop John Shelby Spong.
I don't think Jesus ever preached the Sermon on the Mount, for example. I don't believe anybody ever took five loaves and two fish and fed 5,000 people. I don't believe that's possible to do.
Liberal Bible critic Bart Ehrman.
There's a difference between what the historical Jesus actually said and what the Gospels say he said. And to understand what the historical Jesus was really like, we have to get behind the Gospels.
Muslim critic of Christianity, Reza Aslan.
By definition, the resurrection is an ahistorical event, and so therefore historians have no right, no business commenting upon it.
Where else on Christian radio will you hear these guests challenged with important questions? Talk radio for the thinking Christian, Issues Etc. Listen live or on demand at issuesetc.org.
Daily exercise for the Christian mind. You're listening to Issues Etc.
Take a stand for life. Join Issues Etc. regular guests Matt Harrison, Molly Ziegler-Hemingway, Robert George, and others for the 2015 LCMS Life Conference, January 22nd through the 24th in Arlington, Virginia. The LCMS Life Conference is held in conjunction with the National March for Life. For more information, click the LCMS Life Conference logo at issuesetc.org. It's your time to stand. The 2015 LCMS Life Conference.
Do you have a student finishing up eighth grade at a Lutheran school? Do you wish there were a Lutheran high school close to where you live so your student could continue going to a Lutheran school? What if there was an opportunity for high school students in public or Lutheran school to take classes like Latin, logic, and hard-hitting theology courses? Well, there is. It's called Wittenberg Academy, the first completely online classical Lutheran high school. Visit our website, wittenbergacademy.org, to find out more.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Craig Evans is our guest. We're talking about the reported discovery of the site of Jesus' trial in Jerusalem. I wanted to ask you a little bit about the trials themselves. The first one is, I guess, it's usually broken up into three trials or two and a half. The trial before the elders of Israel, the Sanhedrin, the trial before Pilate, and then within that one there is a rather brief hearing before Herod. What was the nature of the first trial? Why did that have to take place with respect to Jesus' accusers?
Well, what was going to happen is Caiaphas and some of the ruling priests who supported him, and that would include his father-in-law, Annas, who had served as high priest many years earlier, what they wanted to do was to bring a charge against Jesus, a fatal charge, whereby they could deliver him to the Roman governor and have him put to death. And so Caiaphas wants to do this before the Passover takes place. I think he's worried that there could be a riot. Jesus' preaching about the kingdom of God could inspire reckless behavior, even an insurrection on the part of many of the pilgrims and some of the locals. And so Jesus has been carrying on in a provocative way in the temple precincts for most of that week. And so he wants to do something about it, and he wants to do it very quickly. So he has no other choice but to have people gather in his home. Could have been a home, by the way, shared with Annas. The Gospels seem to refer to it the same way. You know, it's Annas' home, according to John. It's Caiaphas' house, according to Matthew, Mark, and Luke. Probably one and the same. We've been talking about archaeology, and a high priestly home would have been enormous. And it had been easy for an extended several families to live in the same house. In any case, he invites into this large home of his likely very sympathetic people who are willing to come and hear the case discussed. And that's why in Mark chapter 14, they all condemn him. Bart Ehrman makes a deal out of this. He thinks he finds a contradiction, but he hasn't read the text carefully. In Mark 14, where Jesus is asked if he's the Messiah, Son of God, and he affirms that he is, and they're shocked, they cry out blasphemy, no further need of witnesses, that they all condemned him. And then in the next morning, and that is chapter 15, that would be Friday morning, they then meet briefly. That's the entire Sanhedrin gathering. And, of course, not all of them condemned him. Nicodemus did not. Joseph Arimathea did not. I suspect there were several other members once the entire Sanhedrin was gathered. And so you have two phases of the Jewish trial. You have the indictment with the recommendation of death, and then you have the confirmation by vote when the whole Sanhedrin is able to gather Friday morning. And that was not unanimous. But it was a large majority, I have no doubt. Then the Roman trial gets underway, and of course, that's what counts. Caiaphas hands Jesus over to Pilate with a strong recommendation that the Roman governor condemn him to death, not merely a beating, not merely a imprisonment, but death. And Pilate, of course, wants to know what he should do. He doesn't want to provoke the Jewish people on the eve of Passover. The last thing he wants to do is be made a fool and do Caiaphas's dirty work. He wants to be cautious on that score, not because he's a humanitarian or committed to justice or cares one rip about Jesus and his preaching. He just wants to make sure he's not being suckered into doing Caiaphas's dirty work. So he inquires, he questions Jesus, he learns things. He's willing to let Jesus go, and I think he's very smart as a politician. he calls for a plebiscite. He calls for a referendum. He wants the people to settle it. And, of course, it turns into a shouting contest. But what's interesting is the ruling priests have allies in the partisans who support Barabbas. And so that's a very interesting irony, and the gospel writers see that, where we have the ruling priests who normally do not like rebels. Rebels don't like the ruling priests either. They're on opposite sides, and here they are. They join up as a coalition and call for the death of Jesus and the release of Barabbas. And so Pilate is willing to do that. But you refer to half of a trial, and that's a courtesy where Herod Antipas is present for the Passover. Jesus is from his jurisdiction, which is Galilee. And so as a courtesy, he invites Herod Antipas, who no doubt remarked he'd wanted to see Jesus before. We know that from Luke's gospel. So he gets his chance to see Jesus, and very likely he encourages Pilate to go ahead and proceed with execution if he wishes.
So finally, with only a minute here, Dr. Evans, the fact that we have this very clear and, I would assert, and I assure you would agree, extremely detailed account of the trial of Jesus, and now perhaps the place where it might have even taken place. What would your final thoughts here on that, the conjunction of those two now for our listeners with about a minute?
Well, I think it makes it clear that the Gospels are accurate. There's just too much coherence. There's the verisimilitude, that is the likeness. The Gospel account agrees with all the evidence we have from other literature, but also from the archaeology. That inspires in us great confidence that the Gospel narratives are accurate. They're sourced in people who were eyewitnesses and knew what they were talking about. And so from my point of view as a historian, I find that very reassuring that we're reading an account that is authentic and reliable.
Dr. Craig Evans is professor of New Testament at Acadia Divinity College in Nova Scotia, Canada. He's authored several books, including Jesus and His World, The Archaeological Evidence. Dr. Evans, thank you very much for being our guest.
You're very welcome. It was very enjoyable.
Tomorrow on Issues Etc., we're going to talk with Dr. Albert Moeller of Southern Baptist Theological Seminary about the Newsweek magazine cover story on the Bible. It's one of those perennial things that always happens around the holiday season. We're also going to discuss the impact of natural marriage on women and children. Dr. Brad Wilcox of the University of Virginia will be our guest. And we'll get Terry Mattingly's thoughts on the movie Unbroken. That's tomorrow on Issues Etc. It should not surprise us that the deeper we dig, whether it be in Holy Scripture or in secular history or in likely spots of these things having really taken place, like Jerusalem, the more we find. Now, history has in some ways conspired to cover up a lot of the physical evidence there, but again and again and again, the archaeologist's spade overturns and exposes things that come as no surprise to those who look at the New Testament accounts of the life, the suffering, the death, and the resurrection of Jesus as true accounts of real history. No surprise to those who trust the testimony that has been left to us by the eyewitnesses of what Jesus has done for us and for the world. I'm Todd Wilkin. I'll talk with you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
Hello, this is Pastor Kevin Golden of Village Lutheran Church in Ladue, Missouri. The saints at Village Lutheran are proud to be part of the Issues Etc. 300, sharing in their Christ-centered, cross-focused proclamation of the gospel. If you find yourself in St. Louis, join us on Sundays at 8:15 and 10:45 for the Divine Service, 9:30 for Bible study and Sunday school, as we receive Christ's gifts of forgiveness, life, and salvation. Or visit us on the web at www.villagelutheranchurch.org.
Oh, morning star, of morning star, shine with God's light across the world.
Listen to the best of the church's music for the Epiphany season at LutheranPublicRadio.org. Sacred music for the Epiphany season, 24/7, LutheranPublicRadio.org.